My name is Eric Jorsted, and this is our fifth and final session in the series Community, Crimes, and Justice. The title today is The Church in Action. A better title might have been The Church Responds to the Problem of Community, Crimes, and Justice. What we've been doing over the course of the week is looking at starting focusing on the human experience of crimes. We've looked at the great variety of the types of crimes. We've started to look at what is it that are the sources of these crimes, how have these crimes started to come about. We've looked at the experience of victimization. We've talked a bit about what we can do to reduce crimes. That was our second session. In our third session, we looked at what do we do once we catch criminals? Do we punish them, or do we lead some process of reconciliation? And we found an element of both. We had our forum in the middle of this on the death penalty, which heightens all the issues related to criminal sentencing by focusing on such an ultimate penalty as death. And finally, on Thursday, we became a model caring community. And we set up a scenario of a victim, a victimizer, and a particular kind of crime. And we waved our magic wand and we created all these wonderful institutions and caring people and wonderful responses to deal with it. As I was coming out of the session, someone said to me, I always have mixed feelings about these brainstorming magic wand kind of sessions. Because on the one hand, they always come up with all these great ideas, but on the other hand, they can be pretty disconnected from reality. And the question is, what can we actually do? Not just what do we think ought to be done, but what can we actually do? Not just what is ideal, but what is possible when it comes to dealing with the problems of human evil as we've studied them in the experience of crimes. So that's what we're going to try to do today. We're going to plant our feet solidly on earth and move forward as a church in action. To start with, I'd like to do some background on what I call the theology of God's loving justice, which will take probably 10-12 minutes. And then we'll move into some particular models and areas for Christians to be involved with community crimes and justice. And we'll discuss them and see how they relate back to you. First, let me ask, how many of you are here for the first time in the series today? Okay, about six people. That's about par for the course. We've had about a third of new people every time. I hope what we say today is going to make some sense. I've just given a brief review of what we've done. I couldn't give a very thorough overview of where we've come so far. But today will be our theological and our church-centered day. And the first thing to be said under a theology of God's loving justice is that there is no blueprint in the Bible which tells us how to organize our response to the problem of crimes. We can learn from many biblical themes, and we're about to go into some of them, but we can also learn from people with experiences of victimization and victimizing and experiences with the criminal justice system. I've got a question for those of you who have been here all week. How many times have you heard references to God so far this week?
Not a lot.
Not a lot. I haven't heard any complaints about that. Heard a few complaints? Oh. How many times have you heard reference to theology? Even less? Well, I thought it was a little more, actually, but I think I referred to theology twice this week. Well, there is a theological reason why I have not been talking about theology so far. That is because I hold to a strong doctrine of the first article, or a strong theology of creation. Namely, when it comes to dealing with public issues that cut across religious lines that aren't focused within the institution of the church, that human reason and human experience are the starting point. And if the goal is human justice, all the more do we focus on human experience and reason. And so we've been looking at what the human experience of crimes is about, and what the human systems of justice have done and haven't done, and what we can do as neighbors in communities to respond to those issues. That's all grounded in first article kinds of stuff about human beings made in the image of God. Today we're looking at the church as an institution which responds to this human experience. Now we could do a whole nother session, and I've done them here before, about Luther's two kingdoms and first and second articles and theological justifications for Christians and public policy and all of that. And if you want to engage sort of the methodology of this course later on, I'll be glad to go at that with you. But I thought I'd tell you a little bit about how this thing has been organized. But today I would like to start by looking at the biblical sources which have to do with God's loving justice. The first thing to say about God's loving justice is that, yes, God is just, but God's justice is a biased justice. God's justice is not impartial. God's justice is biased in favor of the poor, the powerless, the weak, and the vulnerable. And God's justice is biased against those who hurt them. So God's justice is not an impartial justice, but a loving justice. And it just occurred to me this morning that what I'm suggesting, in a sense, is a whole new title to our summer theme that I think might have actually been more fruitful. Instead of gentle justice, say, loving justice. How can Christians facilitate a loving justice? Well, let me read a couple passages that undergird this. First is from Psalm 72, which says, "Give the king thy justice, O God. May he judge thy people with righteousness and thy poor with justice. May he defend the cause of the poor of the people, give deliverance to the needy, and crush the oppressor." God's bias towards the poor and against the oppressor. And then in the New Testament, Luke chapter 4, Jesus says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed." So God cares about life and community. He particularly cares about those who are being hurt, and he passes judgment on those who are hurting them. Now I'd like to look briefly at how the Old Testament embodies this notion of loving justice, and then look at what the New Testament changes and adds regarding it. That's coming up in a minute over here. In the Old Testament, the key concept is shalom, which means peace, as well as hello and goodbye. Been listening to John and Mary Schramm, I imagine they've been talking a lot about shalom during the week. I would define shalom as wholeness of life in a community of justice and right relationships. Wholeness of life in a community of justice and right relationships. In the Old Testament, social inequalities are as blameworthy as individual acts of crime. And the right relationships within community have as much to do with wealth and poverty, with power and powerlessness, as they do with individual conflicts between persons. Both are seen as ruptures or wounds within the community, wounds which need to be healed. And when it comes to crimes, with the most serious crimes, murder, blasphemy, adultery, and so on, in the Old Testament, the consequence is retribution, usually death as a penalty, stoning at the hands of the community. They don't turn it over to some outside agency. It's stoning at the hands of the community. So there was retribution within the community, restoring the community, if you can call that restoring, in the face of serious human evil. But when it came to less serious crimes, assaults and all property crimes, the result was restitution and repair of relationships within the community. And there's an interesting connection in the Hebrew. Shalom is the word for restitution. Shalom is what makes shalom possible. Shalom restores shalom within the community. And so in the Old Testament community of faith, there was retribution in the most serious crimes, and there was a person-centered and community-based restitution and repair of relationships when it came to the kinds of crimes, for example, that we talked about on Thursday when we had the home burglary. That was the goal. In the New Testament, the context has changed. It's no longer that the covenant community of faith is identical to the civil community of law. The Christian church lives under Caesar. It doesn't just create and enforce its own laws, as did the faith community in the Old Testament. And further, Jesus introduces some new themes into the question of crimes. The first is that there are no us versus them divisions. The texts are under number A up there. Jesus says, "Let the one who is without sin cast the first stone." Jesus says that you should not condemn the speck in your brother or sister's eye without first noticing the log in your own. Jesus says, "Judge not, and you will not be judged. Forgive, and you will be forgiven." And so, which of us does not have that log in our own eye? Which of us is not guilty ourselves? Who of us has the right to pass judgment? Jesus says there is no us versus them division when it comes to the law-abiding and the criminal citizens. In that sense, we're not split. Secondly, Jesus emphasizes reconciliation and forgiveness. In the passages listed, the first is the prodigal son. The goal there is reconciliation, as the son is welcomed home in the family. In the parable of the lost sheep is brought back, no questions asked. In the parable of the laborers in the vineyard, they all receive the same pay, not depending upon their merits, but upon the owner's generosity. And when asked how often to forgive, Jesus says, not 7 times, but 70 times 7. So Jesus tells us to love those who offend us. And instead of trying to fix blame in a system of proportional just deserts, Jesus emphasizes forgiving and reconciling love. Thirdly, Jesus emphasizes ministering to the victims of human evil. In the story of the Good Samaritan, which is perhaps the best known story Jesus has told, it's really a story about assisting a victim of crime. It's someone who's beaten and left naked and half dead on the side of the road, who's robbed and mugged. And what does a Good Samaritan do? He provides transportation, medical assistance, financial assistance, puts them up in temporary housing assistance, and sees after the physical needs, binds up the wounds, provides that kind of medical assistance, specific care for the victims of crime. And Jesus says, go and do likewise. And finally, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says these words that came up at our forum on the death penalty and have not ceased to bug Christians ever since. Love your enemy. Love your enemy. I think those apply with particular power to the situation of community and crimes, because in a real sense, those who commit crimes are our enemies. Jesus does not sentimentalize or romanticize the harsher realities of human life. And the fact that people who commit many of these crimes are enemies against individual Christians, as well as against an order of society. But yet Jesus says, love your enemies. Why should we love our enemies? Not because they deserve it, but for the same reason God loves us. Why does God love us? Not because we deserve it, but because it's His grace, it's His gift, it's His nature to pour Himself out and to love. Even while we were yet enemies, Paul says in Romans 5, God showed His love for us that He gave His Son to die for us. So we who are loved by that kind of God should in turn love those who are our enemies, which means loving the criminals and those who commit even the most despicable kinds of acts. Well, that's an overview of some of the biblical themes that have to do with God's loving justice. Before I launch into the next section, how does that strike you? Is this an accurate portrayal of what the biblical themes are as far as you're concerned? Do you have questions, comments? Is this stuff reassuring or is it disturbing when you start applying these parables to the situation of crimes?
I would have an awful hard time when I think of Charles Manson. Yeah, that really bothers me because I have a hard time with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, loving our enemy doesn't mean liking them, doesn't mean having warm feelings. What does it mean then? Maybe we can flesh that one out. Compassion? Well,
you know, I can stand here and think about Charles Manson and I can really feel sorry for him.
Yeah.
And possibly I could give him a hug if he was in a cell.
I don't think I got
it. Well,
an example.
Forgiving, I don't know.
Forgiving? Well, let's see. This is where the rubber hits the road on Christian love.
What about trying in some way to bring them into the vision that we share, the shalom community? That would be, but somehow this also is a person like myself, and they also, God also leads them, is leading them towards shalom, and my commitment is to enable them, to the extent I can, to share in that.
Well, I think that would be my first starting point, is to say yes, because that God loves this person means they are a human being. All this talk about these subhuman animals that we put behind bars is violating what God has created. They're still human beings. Hard as it is to believe. I saw a hand.
Well, I was just going to say that I think what you've done is very accurate and right on target. I think what Jesus and the scriptures call us to do is to create justice at expense of ourselves rather than at someone else's expense.
Hmm.
And we would just love to have justice as long as someone else pays for it. But if it means it's at our expense, we tend to shy away and say, well, this is just unmanageable. But that is exactly that's how we are justified, at God's expense rather than our own.
How does that start to get applied in criminal justice for Christians?
Well, it might mean going the long way and with Manson not taking an easy way out and exterminating him. It might mean spending a lot of money and figuring out how to incarcerate and, if at all, rehabilitate. But it seems to me that that's, the value of human life is stressed a great deal in those studies. Justice at our expense.
Other thoughts? Go ahead.
Well, my tendency is to think, well, okay, what you're saying is I should love all these people, and my immediate thought is I love them, so therefore I will let them out of prison. But that's not true. There's got to be another, you know, that's the immediate thing. Well, if I love them, I'll just let them go free. Well, that's not right.
You see why this issue cuts so close and is so hard to make sense out of, because it was that excellent question asked at the forum Wednesday night. Is crime sin? And if love has to do with sinners, crime has to do with criminals. And if we love sinners, does that mean that we release criminals? And how does Christian love for individuals then relate to public policy, what we want to do as a society? Can this at our own expense nature of Christian love be something that we try to build into the criminal justice system? I raise that as a question.
The model that you've put out, too, I think is not the operating model that we've had as Christians in this country in terms of our understanding of the criminal justice system. I think at least the implied model that I was raised with was a model that said that one, there's two worlds. There's a world of the church and there's a world of the state. And over here under the state, it operates under the realm of power and justice. And my understanding of justice was not putting things right, but giving to those that deserve what they deserve. And also protecting the safety of the rest of the folks in the community. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the civil government is given the power to kill people and to use all sorts of force to do that. And that's their job. And our job over here has to do with saving their souls, if we can, mm-hmm. with their spiritual enlightenment. Yeah. And that's a different model than what you're talking about here.
Definitely
is. But I think that we need to lift that up and say, I think there's a lot of people that have functioned according to that, and the church has for a long time.
Mm-hmm. We have a more substantive, positive, and God-centered notion of justice, which we expect out of the public realm, as I've been defining it. Than that notion would have, and a more worldly, community-centered notion of what the church is on about than that model, right. Also, according to the way. It cuts both ways. They're both drawn towards similar projects without the same kind of split in the model I've presented. And that goes back to my theological orientation I bring. Yeah?
Listening to a comment about Charles Manson and possibly husband, I think it would all depend upon your own personal experience. If we were sitting in a group like this and talking about Charles Manson way over here, we could see all kinds of ways of offering love and so on. But if that Charles Manson affected somebody in your family, I think my huggy would be a little tighter around me.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And yet I can't help thinking of Dean when you say that, and the way that these folks embraced a person in our congregation who had killed his mother and stuck with him through that process of incarceration and enabled him to re-enter life again and supported him as friends and really led to, I think, a new start for that person.
Yeah. Well, it's possible to love your enemy. Could tell stories of that too. Go ahead.
I took young people in, or young men in, to play ball in prison. And we went in there, and of course, you're allowed to talk to the prisoners. The first baseman says, "Oh, you're from up Marina Antigua? Yeah, I got married in that church up there." He says, I got 80 days to go. Another guy out in the field there, he says, that's where the cops quartered me up there in that town. Well, now you take those young fellas in there and they see this and coming out, they say, well, what kind of a woman is marrying some guy just sitting in a jug? You know? And the last time I went in there, I had about five of them come up and tell me, he said, this is our last trip. Well, no more to do with this place. because they said it's harder for us to get in here to play ball than it is for them guys to get out. And they were never, you know, you know, I never really thought about it until we got out of there, of what these young fellows were thinking.
Yeah.
You know,
this
wasn't for them.
Well, that starts to put some, you know, flesh on these notions. You can talk in the abstract about, you know, high-sounding theological phrases like love your enemies. But when you start getting into the heart of the experience, you realize, for one thing, it's a process and it's not simply a decision. And just what's involved. That's a good lead-in. I'm gonna cut things off. I'm going to bring your story in just a minute here. That we were talking about earlier, a couple days ago. I want to move into our next section now. We obviously didn't answer that one, did we? But I hope you're at least a little enlightened and a little perturbed at the notion and can chew on it some more yourself. And if you had... go work back through some of those texts and think, what does this have to do with criminal crimes and justice? You all have a lot of food for reflection. As I look at it, there's two broad ways for the church to be active in community crimes and justice. The first I call ministries with persons. And the second is ministries with human systems. The first has to do with person-to-person ministry, and the second has to do with the kind of advocacy about the ways that laws can be changed and institutional factors, societal, social structures, and so on, which impact the question of crimes, can be changed. And under both of them, there's a variety of things that can be done. What I'd like to do first is to just list them out rather briefly, just take a couple minutes for that. Then we're large enough today that I'm going to want us to break up into small groups for a couple minutes and for you to talk about your home situation and what's already being done and what's not being done and what kinds of things out of this list might you consider doing in your home situation. Then we'll bring it back into the larger group and flesh out a couple of the models a little bit more so you have a few more specifics. First thing that can be done in ministries with persons is ministry with victims. And your community may already have things like victim service centers. Maybe there's a special office or a desk at the police department. You may have a victim hotline information number, which is manned 24 hours. That's often what people will call first, maybe even before the police in certain kinds of cases. There's rape crisis centers, which help rape victims work through their experience. There's shelters for victims of domestic violence. There are victim witness assistance programs. There are victim restitution programs. And finally, there's victim compensation programs, which are not person-to-person restitution, but is a compensation from the state for the loss in a crime. So all of these are ways that we can develop specific ministries with victims of crime. How many of you were here when we talked about VORP? Not that many. This is a... we've had about the same number every day, but there's apparently been a lot of turnover in the group, people coming and going. VORP stands for Victim Offender Reconciliation Program. It's a creative program started by the Mennonites, and it's described in great detail in this book, which is over in the bookstore, Crime and Reconciliation: Creative Options for Victims and Offenders. Essentially, it's a program voluntary where the victim and the offender agree to sit down and meet face to face with a third party, a trained mediator present. The victim can ask questions like, why me? How did you get in? Why did you destroy so many things when all you wanted was my jewelry? Whatever the personal questions the victim has about the crime. The offender meets the victim face to face and is confronted with the reality of what they have done. And then the two work out a restitution agreement, which the third party, the program, oversees that it's carried out. So it's a way of personalizing the process between victim and offender.
Did you say it was sponsored by the Mennonites?
Mennonites initiated it.
Initiated?
Yeah. It's non-religious, technically. It's,
so where are the teeth?
The teeth is that two parts. One is that if the agreement is not carried out, you can go back to court for sentencing to prison. So it's voluntary alternative to prison, but if you don't do it, you're going to jail anyway. And secondly, it's usually part of a larger sentencing program. We looked at a couple examples on Wednesday of chemical dependency treatment that was a court order as part of it. One was 30 days in jail in addition. And another had 200 hours of community service in addition.
So this
to the
is more or less
program.
One of the programs of the justice system.
So it's one of the programs of the justice system, but it's not quite in system. It's a separate outside group which has the motivation to see that it actually works, unlike most of the probation and alternatives actually in system. The third broad area of ministries with persons is ministries with the victims and family violence, victims and victimizers. There's a great number of programs available, and those in the ALC, I recommend the recent paper that was put out on domestic violence. The LCA or anyone else could try to get a hold of that too. We've already had mention of this one, playing ball with the prisoners. There's other programs. There's a whole PVS, Prisoner Visitation Services. Prisoner Visitation and Support Program is a nationwide ministry that can help people get started and does training and so on. So if you're interested in actually getting inside the prison, that's a possibility. Another one is just starting in the ALC, prison congregations. There's a congregation actually in the prison at a Maryland Correctional Institution for Women in Jessup, Maryland, that was received into the Eastern District of the ALC. And that's a model that may spread to other prisons as an alternative to traditional chaplaincy notions. And you can also work with transition needs between helping prisoners make the kinds of contacts that are going to enable them to move from within the walls to outside the walls once they leave. And finally, there's chaplaincy, which can either be a chaplain paid by the correctional institution itself, which has advantages of being in system, or can be paid by Lutheran Social Service or an outside kind of agency, which has advantages of autonomy in programming. So chaplaincy and support of chaplaincy is another possibility. Let me put over here. Ministries with human systems. One has to do with something I think is sorely lacking in the church, and that's ministry with criminal justice personnel. I think we ought to be having conferences nationwide or region-wide where you bring together prison guards, where you bring together wardens, a conference of Christian wardens, a conference of Christian prison guards, a conference of Christian lawyers, a conference of Christian public defenders, to talk about the ways that Christian faith impacts the kind of work that's done within the criminal justice system. Another way of working with systems is through networks. There's a great variety of organizations which hold conferences and so on around the nation, and there's a Lutheran directory, a directory of Lutheran justice ministries that's available, that lists out some 80 ministries that are already being undertaken by Lutherans in criminal justice. I'm going to put a whole bunch of acronyms up here. That's enough. There are also more localized organizations which are working to reform the justice system. Team for Justice is in Detroit, and they work with prisoners and in the community with churches and education, and they work with developing legislation for criminal justice reform. MOCAI is Missouri Coalition for Alternatives to Imprisonment, and they work with the VORP kinds of models of alternative sentencing and so on. National Council on Crime and Delinquency is chiefly education, but they also develop policy alternatives in the criminal justice field. There's also the National Interreligious Task Force on Criminal Justice, which is a more church-based organization, working to change the human systems, working to reform what's actually done. I feel right now like I'm throwing a dozen snowballs at you, and you're all just getting buried in ideas. What's the best thing to do to start to bring this home? Do you want to break up into small groups to see how does this relate to home, or do you need some more information before you're ready for that?
Well, I like to listen to you talking.
I get tired. I told you I'm a preacher. I can only talk for 20 minutes. Then I need a response.
If you'd like, we'll stand up.
You can stand up and do the creed, and then I'll. Then I can go on to the prayer. Well, community. I mean home community. That's when, you know, the forum last night was how you take Holden home. I couldn't get there. I had the other two members of my family who were both not feeling well. But how do you take Holden home is sort of what I'm trying to do at the end of this session. This series is motivate you with some ideas to go back into your home congregations and communities and to say, well, that was not just something interesting, but maybe I can do something about it. At least I'm going to find other people who maybe together we can do something about it.
Well, I'm looking at all those little items under number one, and I don't see anything in there that's being done, you know, in our congregation. And I don't even know within our city. I wonder if anybody else is doing, you know, was aware of those kinds of things happening in our area. I'm not aware.
Let's start by, what I'd like to start with is to get a sense of it sounds like what we want to do is work together in a large group here for a while.
Yeah.
Okay, I can live with that, I'm not going to. Let's, just a second here, what I'd like to do first is to get a sense of what kinds of communities we come from. How many come from a city of larger than 200,000? Not much. How about, you know, your medium-sized city, 50,000 to 200,000? That's a good number. How about your small town, which is anywhere from 1,000 to 50,000 in the way I'm broadly sweeping it? That's small town. How about rural?
Yeah, we're small town.
There's rural or small.
Smaller than 1,000.
That's rural in my mind. Well, we come from a great variety here. We don't have a whole lot of real big cities, but we've got a lot of medium-sized cities to small towns. Not very many real rural and small town, because that's going to be another kind of situation. You had your hand up.
Well, I think one gentleman brought up the point, didn't think that anything like this was going on in his area, and I probably would say that there's probably more going on in your area than you realize. Unless you've been affected by the system or been part of it, you don't really realize how much is there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes we make the mistake of not going to the, you know, police, sheriff, whatever department, say, what can we do? Because they have programs all set up. But people shy away from it until it touches them. Then they want to get in.
Yeah, that is often the case. Sort of in the abstract, it's hard to know about it. And it's something we don't really want to know about.
Right.
I've been surprised at the turnout that we've had at these sessions this week. I thought, you come to Holden Village, nobody locks the doors, you're 50 miles from the nearest telephone, you're long away from home. What you don't want to hear about is things like crime. Apparently there is a lot of interest. But it's not the kind of thing that you just sort of naturally want to go find out about. I mean, it's one thing to go find out about the concert schedule or the high school football team, which is a lot more fun to get involved with. But once you have the personal experience, you're brought into it and you realize there's a lot of good people who are already doing interesting things.
But there's some police departments think that some of these organizations are getting in their way.
Well,
they don't always agree.
There's Team for Justice, for example, which is the one I know best because I'm in Detroit and I know the people there pretty well. They've got kind of a mixed, ambivalent relationship with the powers that be. On the one hand, they're in the system providing a great deal of chaplaincy-type services and kind of therapy groups. One person who does a work that I just can't conceive of doing is with repeat sex offenders, especially those who've molested children, sexual offenders who've molested children. And I just think, what does he do with them? But he's got an incredible ministry, and he's within the system, within, you know, the prison. He meets with them there over a course of a couple years worth of therapy and so on. And then he tries to educate the community as well. So we've got there, they've got in-system kind of people, but then they also develop these alternatives to imprisonment, and they've got a couple state representatives who are kind of in their corner who present legislation and so on that the rest of the system doesn't like at all. So they're both confrontive and in at the same time, and it keeps them on their toes.
Still, you have cases where there's sex offense in the families and stuff, and the powers that be aren't educated good enough to come out and handle it. You go out and question the kid and say, "Hey, is this happening to you?"
Yeah.
And what's the kid going to say? You know, they're going to say what they want them to say. Yeah. And then they go back and they're going to throw these guys in jail. Yeah. We just had a great big blow up back in Minnesota about this.
Yeah.
And the district attorney and everybody else for the county just did a terrible job.
What you're touching on is that when it comes, particularly here, criminal justice ministries shades over into social services in certain kinds of cases, and especially when you're dealing with families. Social workers and the criminal justice workers sort of shade off into who's doing what when, and it blends in together.
Here they broke up a whole community. The whole community. The thing
was
Jordan case?
Okay, Jordan. I was still in Minnesota when it broke, and I moved to Detroit since.
So they threw everything out.
Nothing came of it.
Nothing came.
So if there was some guilty people, what happened?
No prosecution? I mean, no conviction?
One person confessed. They didn't have the facts.
Didn't have the evidence?
No.
It felt the evidence was questionable.
Yeah. What kind of case was that?
Sex offense, right in families, from the mother and father to the grandfather and grandmother. You buy that one. And they never had enough proof to prove anything. But now, whether they were guilty or not, we don't know.
Well, there's another part of ministering with victims that I want to take a minute to consider. And that's a story that was shared with me. Is it Pastor Fredrickson?
Fisher.
I remember the first letter at least. I'm sorry about that.
That's close.
You won't claim the German name there. But the story you were sharing with me about the particular, the kidnapping and the ministry that you had and the faith, that the difference that Christian faith made, if you could take a couple minutes and tell us that story.
I was called up by the police department and was asked to go see a member of mine whose little 10-year-old daughter had been kidnapped, and they didn't want any of this to go out because it had the other secrecy. So this little girl was 10 years old, and immediately I went over there, and I spent the next 6 days, spent at least 2 or 3 hours a day over there, not able to tell anybody what's happening. And the trauma that the couple goes through in their 10-year-old daughter's kidnapped, especially when the police department tells you, don't expect to ever see this little girl alive again, because there's no reason why that killer should let her go. So he prayed for one thing, and that was that God would touch the heart of that man, and that he would release her. And the time went on, telephone ringing, and so forth. And it was just a traumatic situation. I don't know, you have to go through it yourself to understand the feeling of a mother. She had lost her first husband to cancer. This was her daughter, and the man had gone through a traumatic situation at the divorce and so forth. But they had gotten married, and I hadn't married them. Well, anyway, then I was there one day, and the telephone wasn't working. And they were waiting for this call. He had been calling and calling. And finally they arranged for the money to be exchanged, $250,000 in old black bag, you know, it's right there. And so even I said, can you do it? And he said, yeah, I've got that tape, I've got to do it, and I'll do it. I said, well, if you can't, I'll help you, if you're with you, anything. And he really appreciated that fact. And then the first setup came, and the media blew it. They followed this guy, the father, who's taking the money. And so they thought, now it's really gone. And so, but the next day he called back, and the policemen were very efficient in our town. They spotted the call by sheer accident, and they knew who he was. This guy had killed his 3 children and his wife, so I mean, he was a real killer. But the second drop off, he picked up the money and dropped off the kid at a hospital. She was still in her pajamas. She had been sick that morning. He had washed and everything. And they called immediately and told me that they called her, and that God had answered their prayers. They were so thankful. And then the little girl, I talked to her on the phone, I asked her how she was. She says, fine. She'd been hauled around, locked in closets and everything. And she said, Jesus was with me all the time. And this little girl, because of her faith, she went to counseling, but she never reacted badly to any prayer. She spoke even and so forth. And they stayed out of town for a while because they didn't want all publicity and so forth that followed. Then they got back to town. We set up a Thanksgiving service for them, in which we gave special thanks to God. And the priest of the town, they brought her after Thanksgiving service. The little girl said, can I show them? And mother said, yes. She went to room and brought out a great big teddy bear dressed like a cop. It really helped. And then the little girl told me, I gave both the parents and the pastor a cross with God is love on there, you know, so that they would always remember that to react in loving ways and so forth. And
well, that's such a powerful.
That they carried that with them wherever they went, and they looked back, you know, so that they could see God's love not only for them, but concerned for the situation that they're involved in.
Yeah, there's a couple things that stand out in my mind. One, especially, in terms of ministry with victims, that we haven't talked about at all yet, and that's the pastoral role.
and how many in our congregations, there's several pastors in the room, I know, how many in our congregations go through that kind of an experience? Well, probably not very many that kind. But there are a great deal of victimization, from family violence to property crime to violent crime. And the role, the particular kind of confidentiality, which was crucial in your situation that you could have, plus the ongoing relationship with the family and the obvious care they knew you had for them in the ongoing relationship that had been established. And then the second thing is just the role of personal faith in the whole process and the testimony of that girl.
I tried to bring in other families in too after the thing too, but yeah, visit them and share.
And so the whole congregation became involved. Yeah. I hadn't heard before about that service of Thanksgiving. That's wonderful. There should be, we should have an institutionalized form. I mean, there should be a little service in the LBW, or at least in the occasional services book. That's a service of Thanksgiving for those who survived trauma. Yeah, I don't know if that's in there.
That's right.
There's an idea. So ministry with persons, pastoral care. But what, as I'm thinking, there's three different things going on here, three ways to be active. One is in the system itself, there's already, you know, victim service offices and that kinds of things. And I'd encourage you, when you go back to your community, probably look in the phone directory, look under the police department, make some phone calls, see what's already available in your community. Are there rape crisis centers? Is there a victim assistance hotline? Those kinds of in-system type programs may or may not already be there. And if Mothers Against Drunk Driving is another good example.
Usually a victim crisis line oftentimes will have, they'll tell you a whole list of those things. You call one, they know dozens.
Right. I've got, for example, if you'd call me, I've got a community services directory that's 400-some pages. And I'll go into my index, I mean, from Metro Detroit, we're talking 4.5 million people. But I'll go in there and target down the index and give them four different options of where to go next. I don't provide much direct service myself, but I can help them find someone who can help them find someone, at least. So I'd recommend you're doing that in your own community and see what's the lay of the land look like in terms of the services that are already there in system. And then secondly, what kinds of church-based networks are there around in your state, in your area? Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota, for example, I know they have chaplaincy programs. Yeah. I'm sure they have other kinds of social service type ministry with victims and offenders programs that are there. Invite a speaker to come to your congregation from the LSS of your area. Or if there's a prison chaplain that's within a driving distance, have him come, or her come, probably is going to be a him, to speak with your congregation and learn what it's like and the kinds of things that are available. And then the third place is specifically within your congregation and your neighborhood, your community. What's there in your smaller locale, in your turf? What can you do as a caring congregation, as a caring community, to work specifically with the people in your congregation? If you have a large church, you're probably going to have a whole lot to deal with if you're in any city type setting, or maybe even elsewhere too. Go ahead.
Just to give you an example of one thing that's going on in our community is that our congregation has joined together with several other congregations in the area. And we have now purchased a home in our community to house persons who are victims of family violence, primarily, or who are going through major problems within the family.
Sure.
Provide them temporary shelter for 30 to 60 days. And this is like a cooperative ecumenical venture, because something like that we could not financially do as one congregation.
Right. But it is an issue that brings churches together.
Yes.
There's nothing closer to the heart of anyone's faith than the Good Samaritan. And caring for victims of violence like that can certainly bring people together. That's a great example. Yeah.
You know, the question I have, though,
is about our system altogether. How could that man be, he killed his wife and children, how can he be on the loop?
He was an escapee, wasn't he?
That's another story. He was on work release, and he wasn't supposed to be on work release, but there's a little corruption in the system, see? And he was let out, and what he did, he went out working for his brother, and he never worked a day for his brother, but he'd always report, sign off the sheet, and made a lot of money doing his regular business, do you see? And that's why this couple now is taking the state to task on the injustice of the mercury system and the inequities and the little bit of corruption.
It's a perfect example of why you need an outside group, voluntary, like VORP, to oversee the alternatives, because in system it tends to be a kind of, either they're in prison or they're probation, work release, so on, which just isn't taken with the same kind of seriousness. And to put teeth into that, as you were asking for, takes people who care to put teeth into it and to make it work. And in the system, it doesn't always happen that way. Well, I'm aware we've got 2 minutes left in our 5 sessions worth. Are there any more kinds of questions and comments? Are there things you came to these sessions with that you were expecting that hasn't been included, that you want to have a chance to bring in?
Just one thing, that is be careful, because most of these those that break the law are common people. They can really come and they have stories.
That's why I like to emphasize, love your enemy.
Yes,
because you realize the actual state that many of these people will look at you as an enemy too.
Yeah.
And we don't come into it with a kind of romanticized or sentimentalized notion of who we're talking about.
Isn't there a quote about that in the Bible? Saying something about you're loving your enemies, you still can't be blind to the fact that they're like snakes.
What is it? Innocent as... Wise as serpents and innocent as doves? What's that quote?
Mm-hmm.
And the wise as serpents part of it is what it takes. And you're going to get burned. Anyone who tries it at all is going to get burned a few times first. Get taken for a few extra bucks here and there that is going to get drunk up or whatever. But you start to learn after some time. And the other whole thing I just realized that's not up there is all the chemical dependency and drug abuse programs that impact crime so deeply. I don't know how I missed it. Go ahead.
One facet that I don't think has been addressed either is the families of the incarcerated person.
Yes.
Because, you know, the drug addict family, that whole sector.
We have a program in the East Bay area of San Francisco called Friends Outside, and they focus primarily on ministry to families of the prisoners, which is a very...
Yeah, that I would imagine most large metro areas have something similar to that already in place. Smaller areas, it might be an excellent project. And it's precisely the transition from prison out that is so crucial, and where a couple people, a congregation that cares, a few people in a congregation that make a bridge can make all the difference in someone's future life.
We have one program for drugs. I mean, parents of drugs. That's tough love. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
Tough love?
Yeah.
Tough love. That's a vanity program.
Sounds good. That's sort of the theme.
All sorts of people, college professors.
Absolutely.
Everything.
Absolutely. It's sort of the theme I'm suggesting here of loving justice.
That's
exactly. Yeah. Well, this has been a great set of sessions. I hate to cut it off.
I think we are good.
Thanks. If you're here next week, I'm doing a series called Faith and Law, which will not look at crime, but at law. So.